Welcome to Muse and Hearth, a podcast for women cultivating mind, heart, and home. I'm Lydia Fukushan.
And I am Valerie Abraham.
And today we have Jordan LaFon joining us. Jordan and her husband and five kids, with one on the way, live on 7 acres in North Idaho on the Palouse. We're excited to have her here to discuss all things homesteading and small farming. Thanks for coming today, Jordan.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So I think we all have a little bit of a vested interest in this topic because I live on 5 acres with my husband and kids. Mm-hmm. And
we live on 6 acres with kids and a few small bipeds and quadrupeds.
So definitely something we've had on our minds. But Jordan, you guys have owned your farm for how long now?
Let's see. We've been on our current property. I believe we're coming up on 5 years.
Okay. So Jordan brings in a lot of experience that she's blessed us with because she's helped us through some goat questions.
Oh, yes.
Experience through error, lots and lots of error.
But I feel like that's the way of this particular world, it seems like.
Really, it is. You can read as many books as you can possibly come up with, but it's not going to give you the knowledge that just for hands-on experience and learning through failing is going to teach.
Yeah, I feel like even just jumping in with the goat that we just bought, where we're finding out from discussing with Jordan, mm-hmm. and with having her have kids and then milking her, that she probably had some milking issues early on. Right. And we probably could have detected that if we knew what we were doing just by looking at her.
But oh, look, a goat. Let's take it home.
The things you learn as you go along anyway.
Right. But, you know, even if someone had told you before, it really doesn't click until you have to do it hands-on. Yeah, and I can't tell you how many details. Goats and cows we've purchased and made the investment in that turned out to be
And you grow, you kind of gain an eye for what's going to work and what isn't. And then you know what you should turn down and what you shouldn't.
And then you can learn to avoid the really big disasters.
And I think part of the reason I'm so excited about talking on this topic is, especially given the political climate and the way things have gone with supply chain and everything else, mm-hmm. it's a big discussion nowadays.
Yeah.
Right.
How can we be more sustainable, self-sustained mm-hmm. as families? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are just starting out and cutting their teeth on what it is to be a homesteader or a small farmer. Mm-hmm. And there's just almost like too much information out there to get started. Like
all the influencers.
Yes.
All the accounts telling you how to do it.
That have been doing it for a whole year and now they have a lot of things to talk about. Yes. it's definitely been a trending topic. And so
Right. Yeah, I think it's important to discuss and chat about it when you've had some experience under your belt, what that looks like.
The other thing that's been challenging, I found, just as we've started getting into it ourselves a little bit, is, and I've talked to you about this, Jordan, then on the other extreme, so you have like these homesteads, micro farms on Instagram or whatever, but then if you look up information online, you often end up with these very official resources mm-hmm. that are designed for basically industrial farms, and it's really hard to apply those concepts or to even figure out which of those concepts ought to apply mm-hmm. when you're mm-hmm. working with, you know, the family milk cow or the family milk mm-hmm. goat.
Where intuitively you might do one thing, whereas the official veterinary medicine recommendation mm-hmm. is something completely different or not sustainable for a small
university
farm approach.
Ag
to,
extension page
kind of thing. You don't have access to all the materials you'd need and you have to go find a veterinary hospital to handle even little things, you know?
So everything has to be so by the book when it's on online.
Right. Which I guess I can understand because they could get in trouble otherwise, but it's really hard to glean information unless you have someone to sort of mentor you through.
Yes. Which is why I think it is really important to have someone to go and talk to because as huge of a blessing as the modern online society is for finding out information, it can also be a curse in the sense of you don't know what to agree with, what to follow, whose advice to take, because every person is going to have a different opinion.
Take some and leave some.
Right,
and it's so hard to know which.
It's information, but it's not wisdom.
Right, exactly. And which is something that I think our generation is missing because the generation ahead of us had stopped all the homesteading. And so it kind of skipped a generation. Mm-hmm. And so all of us that are new to this are having to, you know, if we are, you know, blessed enough to still have grandparents alive or aunts and uncles that live in that life, then we can glean from them.
Right.
But, you know, it's not like it used to be in the past. past when you, it was just passed down day to day.
And then there's a lot of us who basically lived in suburbia and just never had any experience other than maybe a dog or a cat with any of this sort of thing. So,
So it's a whole new world for us, for our generation.
Can I ask, how did you then get into homesteading? What drew you to?
Just what I was going to ask.
Great minds, Lydia. Great minds. Right.
I know. I think, that's a, fantastic question for everyone. Because I think it is, there's so many different ways people approach homesteading and so many ways people get into it. For me, I do have the blessing of having relatives that were in that world. So my grandma is still a cattle rancher.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, all the stories
type
of cattle rancher. And my uncle is a homesteader, a big time homesteader. So they have never gone a day without milking a cow.
Wow.
Both he and his wife, they just grew up totally, totally in that world. And so they know all the ins and outs of it generationally. So they know the generational wisdom, which is a huge blessing. It's also a blessing to have been a part of the skip generation. My parents were definitely not into it. We had dogs and cats, and at one point I think I had a pony. But we were definitely not in the homesteading farming world at all, which kind of gives me a little bit of an outsider's perspective in that I'm okay with new things. So there's kind
coming
of that
with
mix.
A fresh perspective.
Exactly, coming in with a fresh perspective. And especially as we were growing our farm to be more of an income-based thing, it was very helpful because I was willing to do the new things that a lot of farmers that are, have been there generationally are not open to.
It's just not traditionally been done, and so they don't
exactly
dive in on it.
Right. And so when they have a harder time making it in our society when everything is, you have to be on social media in order to make a farm profitable. You have to be on those. And so it's kind of been this interesting, especially since COVID and all this uptake of all these small farms. It's been interesting because many of them are not generational, but they're making a lot of improvements because they can go and glean, they can go find mentors that have that generational knowledge, but also have this outsider's perspective of, oh, but there's also new ways to do this, and that's okay.
And it might work smoother if you do.
Exactly. So anyways, I guess getting back to the point, I grew up loving animals. They were just, you know, my favorite time was when we'd go and visit our aunt and uncle, or my grandma, and go, you know, do horse lessons or go see the farm, and we'd stay there. And it was just, I knew that's what I had wanted to do my whole life, is I originally wanted to be a rancher. And so, and then I married my husband. He most certainly was not, not a rancher. And so we kind of lived in town for many years, had our kids, finally convinced him to get our first dog. You know, so it was a long, slow process, and he very, very graciously bought 7 acres for me after I had totally filled every one of our backyard spaces in the homes that we were flipping with every kind of animal.
I could good on get all away of with these in a totally Proverbs 31 way, and I need a little bit more room.
Exactly. It was about the time I was really trying to fit a dwarf goat in our backyard on, you know, a very
which
main
I have
area
heard
town.
Can be done.
It can be. It was not
easy.
It was not easy and was not going to actually work on our property because it wasn't even a quarter of an acre. And so it would have been very costly. And our neighbors would probably not have been too thrilled.
Just loving the mental image of that.
Our goats.
Exactly. So, and my husband loved the idea of just kind of being out of town and having that kind of distance from work to just kind of, now I'm home. And that commute is just this nice kind of decompression time of like, okay, now it's time to go home and be home. And then things just kind of started really quickly. The property we bought was a 100-year-old farmhouse that had been neglected for 100 years. And so it was a lot of hoarders, a lot of that kind of stuff. So we couldn't really see what the property or the house really looked like until we got into it. And then we realized very quickly that all the pastures were very overgrown. You know, it was up to probably our waists as we're walking to our front door.
And I'm assuming you can't necessarily just dive in on that when it's that overgrown. You have
exactly.
to have a plan.
You have to have a plan. And our plan was, our neighbor asked us if he could raise some sheep on our property. Our town neighbor had asked us if he could raise some sheep. And we're like, sure, we'll get some too. And so 2 weeks after moving in, we got 14 sheep. And
that was going to be my next question. Which animal did you start with?
So, started with chickens.
14 sheep is not one or two animals.
14, that was not what I expected to start with. We were definitely planning. You know, of course, planning is never what it It should be, never turns out. We had planned to keep our chickens from in town, and just keep that for a year. And we had dogs and we had rabbits and we had things like that that we had moved out with us. But we had told ourselves no new animals for a year. We needed to get this house livable.
Famous last words.
Exactly. At the time, it was kind of collapsing around us, essentially. But we got the sheep and we started them in our front yard with electric netting, and they grazed it down. And it was amazing because we could actually see what our property was starting to look like. And we moved them around the entire property. And we moved them around the overgrown plum groves.
So they did the good work for you.
They did the good work for us. They saved us a whole lot of mowing.
Get some sheep if you don't want to mow.
Sheep are also the animal that really loves to die.
This is also good to know.
And so having the sheep made us really have to dig our heels in into this homesteading world, because you couldn't just kind of fly by the seat of your pants, because that's what they're doing. And they really tried to die hard.
And I feel like the one of the sort of, I don't want to use the word accusation, that's pretty heavily weighted, but one of the complaints or objections that people have when they look at someone who's going into homesteading as a continued heritage from their family. I feel like the ones of us that haven't done it because the previous generations did it have a little bit more of a people just looking at you like, why are you doing this? And one of the objections I feel like is that you just have rose tinted glasses about the world and how it is. And you have this odd,
it's romantic,
rural, romantic ideal. And I feel like straight out the gate, I want to tell people, no, the animals die. How is that romantic?
I can't tell you how many people come out to visit us and are just like, oh, you are just living the dream. This is the best thing ever.
Idyllic.
Yes, it is. Homesteading, especially after 2020, and after all of the influencers and stuff are posting there, you know, these beautiful farms with these sheep that come to their names and things like that. But what you're not seeing is that those sheep are also trying so hard to get to the other side of the pasture, they will strangle themselves in the fence. Or that they will call out to a coyote when they hear them, so they will come and eat them.
Oh, that's crazy. Is that how the sister of our sheep died? So the sheep we got had a sister, and she's super skittish, and I think it's because her sister died this way. They were kind of separate from the herd, and coyotes got one of them.
Wow.
Guessing they were calling them.
They really don't have, I mean, all of God's creatures have wonderful brains and wonderful designs. Sheep don't. They got short-changed in the brain department. I love them to pieces, and they're so wonderful, and they're so useful for so many things.
Wool and meat and milk.
Exactly.
That gives us a whole new perspective on verses in the Bible, like, all we like sheep. Suddenly that makes so much more sense. It's not just
not terribly flattering comparison.
Exactly. I can't tell you how many times that just while kind of, you know, diving into this homesteading world, I was like, oh, now that's part of scripture makes so much more sense. Like, we're compared to sheep. Ouch.
Yes.
But also, like, we know why.
I don't know if you've ever seen the viral video where someone pulls a sheep out of a crevice and then it bounds and lands right back in the crevice again as soon as he pulls it out.
With its head completely wedged up to the shoulders.
I think so, he's like right in there and was never going to get out. And the guy pulls him and then he just dives right back in.
Which is why I'm sure God compares us to them, is because it's not that we are stupid in our own ways, but God created us very intelligent, but we also very much need a shepherd. And that is what the comparison really applies.
Us from our situation.
It's like we cannot do this without Christ. We cannot do this on our own. And that's just the perfect example when you look at sheep and watch them, is it's just like, yes, we are just like them, and we need God so much. Yes.
But having 14 sheep did not deter you from continuing on. So that says something about your love for it and determination.
So the sheep actually wanting to die is actually what got my my husband, who from before was just being very gracious to me and blessing me with all of these animals to care for. At this point, though, we had a ram that tangled himself in the electric netting and killed himself. And we were gone, and we got home. This was, you know, very, you know, pre the homesteading mindset. And so we were out until like midnight, whatever it is we were doing. We get home and we find the sheep and we're like, oh, okay, well, he's still warm. So
we're going to save this meat. Oh.
And neither of us had any experience with butchering. Any of that, any butchering. Mm-hmm. My husband had never been hunting. We were just not in that world. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have internet out in our shop. So my husband was out in the shop with the rams, stringing him up, hanging him. And I was inside watching YouTube. Yes. And I would come out and I would watch a step and then I'd go out to the
butchering
shop.
101, because we're not going to let this ram go to waste.
Exactly, exactly. And so I'd run out to the shop with the next step and he would do it. And,
wonderful.
And it was this hilarious, hilarious thing and experience with the kids. They all stayed up with us and helped us with it. Yeah. And we let him hang for 2 weeks. And 2 weeks later, we had this most amazing, delicious meat that came right from our property out of an animal that we would have otherwise had to put in a trash bag.
Right. And just lost.
And just lost and taken the loss. And that is when my husband fell in love with it. He loved the meat because he loves good food. We both love good food. And he loves to cook it. He loves to cook the meat.
And learning something intuitively like that, I know, so my husband has done some deer hunting, and that's where he's gained all his knowledge of animal anatomy. Like, he feels like he could probably actually do butchering. Might not be the best job in the world because he doesn't have a lot of experience, but he's now, dressed a lot of deer. Uh-huh. And I think there's something about that gaining a skill intuitively that's really satisfying.
Learning
you know,
on
just,
the job.
We're just here
physically.
On the job getting it done and doing the best we can not to waste it and use it responsibly.
Seeing the fruit of the work and the labor you've done. We had, before that we'd only experienced the having to go and move this electric netting however many times per, we'd move it, I think, once or twice per day, kind of depending on how much they were grazing or how much grass there was. And it's a lot of work keeping them alive and keeping them fed and keeping them with water and salt and all the things that they need. And it's just a lot of work until you can reap the reward of it. And this was reaping the reward, and it was amazing.
And it's hard to know what they need at first, too. You were the one that found out about the salt need and selenium for goats, which I didn't. No, I think
you actually told me about that because I just had a generic.
And
salt
see, I think if we had started in without any of that advice, would have just dove in and skipped that. And I'm sure that animals do not thrive without those, minerals and things that they need.
Right. So. exactly. There's a reason Bible talks about salt a lot. It's very needed.
Yes. For us and the animals.
For us and the animals. Exactly. And luckily we had. Exactly. Luckily the person we had bought the sheep from had told us about the shop salt blocks. Otherwise we wouldn't have known either. We'd have just been like, okay, well, they're grazing. They have grass. They have water.
Sheep eat grass.
Right. There we go. We're good to go. But we forget is that our soils have been depleted in things like salt and selenium and copper, and we have to replenish that with the salt box. And we don't have the wild terrain that we used to, so they're not licking the rocks or the the cave sides and things like that they would have in the past. And so now we have to supplement with the salt box. So there's a whole new learning. You can try to base all of your homesteading knowledge on very past, using biblical references or using, old history, but it all applies in some way, but there's also modern things that we have to make up for.
We have to address issues that we have.
Because the world has changed. And
I think we saw this. I mean, some of this is not confirmed in any way, but a lot of people have been struggling with their hens laying lately. Mm-hmm. And many of us are positing that it's a feed deficiency situation, like not enough protein in the feed or whatever it is. And so, you can't just say, well, the chickens are going, we're just going to throw out grain and they're going to be fine. And we definitely saw this with our chickens recently where we went from no eggs at all to a wonderful yield, especially when they started free ranging again, actually. That was the first change. But then we got some local grain through Matthew and Valerie and it made a huge difference almost overnight.
Right.
And I thought, well, there you go. You can't just feed them anything.
Right. And that's where kind of getting stuck in one way of doing things is not going to work long term is because you have to be willing to adapt to
just
changes. And, there's feed changes, there's whether it's been mandated that they have to change something or whatever it is that changes, we then have to kind of overcome some of those adaptations. With the chicken grain. And I think that a lot of people nowadays get stuck on, I wouldn't possibly give my chickens meat because right. that would make them cannibal.
Right.
Like, well, they are scavengers.
So they will scavenge anything that's out there.
And that's what they need, actually.
Yes.
Well, I was astounded that most backyard flocks, well, I should say most commercial flocks, really the hens aren't raised to live longer than about 18 months, I think. Maybe it's even less before they're culled.
Right.
And so when you have a backyard flock where you're expecting them to live and lay longer and then they go through a molt, they don't have enough protein in the commercial grains to lay eggs and grow back their feathers at the same time. And I was just astounded to figure that out because our scrawny, mangy looking chickens who had lost all their feathers they weren't laying and they weren't even growing the feathers back very well. And we started to add some scraps and other more nutritional things and they came back around.
Same. Almost same timeline as you, I think, too. And ours,
It can be a little bit of a shock when it's like a beautiful flock and then all of a sudden
Terrible. Well, that's one of those things that it used to be back in the day, the oldest son, by the time he turned six or something, had to be the one that during the winter would have to go out and kill a rabbit or a squirrel or something to go and put in with the hens to give them enough protein to last through the winter. And that was just this passed down thing that's what that child did, or the whether it be the oldest or just whoever hit that age at that time. And so then just passed down through all the brothers of who had the responsibility to go out and hunt for the protein for the winter, for the chickens.
Well, and that reminds me also of some of the other anecdotes you're bringing in, just kind of in response to the objection you were mentioning that some people have of romanticism. This is, in many ways, this is how we teach our kids to cope with the world in which are things like death and evil. Like, instead of protecting them in a way, in an artificial way, they have to then, from a pretty early age, face that, but face it in a healthy way instead of just seeing it on TV or reading terrible news stories. Like, this is how they learn to
with
start
a personal
with the
involvement, they should, Lord willing, have more empathy for it. They they've Absolutely. Raised these animals and cared for them possibly, and then to lose one, is a hard thing.
Right. Or have to go hunt for it.
That, yes,
right. And we want to protect our children so much from many of these harsh realities of the world. But in some sense, it's not actually protecting them when we're not letting them see that stuff happen. Because when they can see it, they actually see, like, oh, no, this is the circle of life. This is how it has to be. Something
and
has to die.
And it spares them
to live.
A systemic shock when they're older and more mature if they haven't, haven't experienced it, when it will inevitably be something that becomes a reality in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I remember when we first got chickens, I just remember being like, yes, our oldest son at the time was only, I think, 2.5 or 3, but I could already tell he was just a very, very cautious child. He would scream in his crib if his curtains were not pleated exactly evenly. And I could just see these tendencies and like, okay, I don't want that. I'm raising a man here.
And he's gonna need to be able to have things be a little messy.
Exactly. His poor wife, if I don't help this right now. and so just kind of seeing some of these tendencies, he's just very cautious and very fragile. And anything that he would see, that he'd see a dead bird outside, and just it would be such an emotionally damaging thing. And I remember the first few years of our chicken keeping was the same thing. We'd lose a chick and he would just sob, and it was just this horrific thing. And it's like, and I want him to see that yes, death is awful. We're not meant for death in this world.
We're not trivializing death.
But at the same time, death is a reality that we have to face. But with how God designed it with animals and the fact that they feed us, especially when we got into the butchering and eating and raising meat animals, it was this amazing reality of, yes, but this animal has to die so that we can live.
And we can be grateful for it.
And we can be grateful for it. Yeah. And it's this beautiful blessing. And then, even the chicks that died, as much as it seems like a waste, it's like, well, no, they're going to go in the compost and they're going to create life for the garden. And it's just this whole circular thing, which, of course, points to the cross too, and that we can't live without Christ's death. And it's just kind of this really cool thing in watching our kids kind of piece that all together and be able to see the full reality of it all.
And I think that awareness definitely separates the perspective from more of a Rousseau romantic, we hate the city and culture and all, and we're just going to go be out in nature because nature is
communing
more
with
beautiful
nature
and more real and more authentic. The perspective instead is gratitude for the ways that God provides for us,
right?
And the beauty of nature that he designed. but with our involvement and our husbandry.
Yes. Yes. Well, I think anybody that, you know, any of the points I've heard that are opposed to homesteading, and they're like, well, you're just trying to take your kids out of reality. It's like, no, actually, I'm trying to put them in it. Mm-hmm. Like, this is reality here. Yeah. This is how life works. Yeah. And we're not trying to distance ourselves from that reality. We're also not trying to distance ourselves from civilization and from people. Right. And that's, I think, the difference between, you know, off-grid living and homesteading. There's a huge difference there. Sure, there are some people that are legitimately trying to get away from the world and try to pretend that
humans run.
Right, humans run, exactly. And trying to be completely self-sustaining in all ways because they think that they can. As Christians, obviously, I think we should run from that as well because we can't be self-sustaining. We need God through everything. But homesteading is certainly not that. Mm. It is then the realization that we do need help from outside because we can't do this on our own.
Actually, we've been recently reading a book by Truman. Oh, I'm going to forget the title now. Wait a minute. Something in the modern self.
In the car, even the triumph of something.
Triumph and something of the modern self. We'll put it in the show notes because we're clearly caffeinated.
The rise and triumph.
The rise and triumph of the modern self. And he's actually talking about how a whole social shift has happened in our mindset because of wonderful technologies that we certainly don't want to be rid of, but that we have full control over our, how we get food, you know, death, life and death and health and those kinds of things. And I think that working the land a little bit more closely than a larger farm circumstance really gives you that firsthand knowledge that this is not in my control. When I lost my hive of bees because I had not moved my hive in October, which should have been a safe time. Right. You know, they can handle getting cold, but we had a huge windstorm and the lid blew off and all of my bees got wet. And all I had to do was basically I had to put the lid on and close it up for the winter, shelter it as best I could, and hope for the best, but all my bees died because they got too wet and too cold. And that was something that I could not control. And even if I'd been watching the weather, I really could not have predicted that it would have been that severe. Right. You know, if I were super, super careful, I probably could have gotten a brick on the lid and maybe my hive would have survived. But with the way the wind went, it had lifted a beveled lid off the top. I mean, it was really blowing. So, but it just, you know, it, instead of feeling like I can just have my honey when I want it. I invested in these bees and therefore I'm going to have honey. It was more of a, nope, you know, sometimes things just don't work that way. And we are needing to submit ourselves to God's providence and then get smart too.
Right. Exactly. That's why I crack up when people say that, you know, homesteading is idealistic, you know, and obviously many people can jump into it thinking that it is.
Right.
But when you know the reality of it, it's like, oh, no. The life you're living is idealistic because you think that food's just going to appear out of nowhere.
And like, eggs will always be $1 a pound.
Exactly.
A dollar dozen. I know how we count eggs.
I don't know what kind of eggs you're buying.
I don't know. By the pound, obviously.
By the pound. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. No, it is this funny thing that, you know, actually we can be idealistic in the other way, that it's just like, oh, there's always going to be meat in this stores. There's always going to be honey. There's always going to be produce. And I think 2020 was a big eye opener for a lot of people about, oh, actually, if you break one part of the chain,
it's not too hard for it to all just kind of. It's not super apocalyptic to imagine that the trucks couldn't get from point A to point B full of cargo.
Exactly. We don't have an unlimited supply of toilet paper either.
Yes, as we learned, even though we have a paper factory 45 minutes away from here, it makes toilet paper.
Wait, they
do make toilet paper there, apparently.
I did not know that.
None of it comes here.
I think probably not.
It's just not how it works.
Yes. No, unfortunately.
Exactly. And that's what's so strange.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could harness our own local toilet paper factory?
You know, that is, I think, what's one of the things that feels so foreign when you step back and think about it, about the modern world is, the factory's 45 minutes away. We never see any of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we have wheat grown all around us. We don't probably eat. Well, I guess the big question is, what are we even eating? We don't even know where the wheat comes from when we buy it at the store.
I still get super excited if I ever see Palouse lentils. And I mean, they grow literally right outside my door, but I don't necessarily.
Unless you go to the farmer's market, it's hard to even find.
When I even heard once that, you know, Idaho is known for their potatoes. Mm-hmm. But in Idaho, we don't actually eat Idaho potatoes. We get them from Washington.
Really?
From what I've heard.
And our potatoes go who knows where, but they go somewhere.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just kind of this crazy, crazy cycle of how things work.
Could we be more efficient, guys?
I know. And so, the people who bring up, escapism and, just anything like that. And it's like, well, okay, yes, we can get too idealistic in the sense of we think that we can do everything ourselves, or, if we get into the fear, the fear trap of thinking like, oh my goodness, if I don't grow all of my own food, we're going to die.
Yeah. Which is obviously the flip side. That's definitely a pitfall.
And there is a ditch
fall.
On both sides, but it's also not using wisdom and stewarding when the quote progress we're making is actually taking something that systematically works and making it not work. And that's what factory farming does, is it takes these systems that God so innately designed to work so amazingly and beautifully, and taking them to where, okay, actually, you can't grow on your own now, because if we stop spraying you with this and this and this, you're going to die. And it's just not going to work. And it's also trying to take our labor out of it.
Symbiosis between animals and plants that would normally be there, because we've just sort of, honed it down to this field.
Yep, the monocrops.
And the soil diversity.
The soil ends up being less nutrient dense.
Oh, yeah, totally depleted.
And also what you said about labor. Our labor being involved in it. So last night, as I was trying to find my Wendell Berry book, book of essays that I had, I finally found it right as we were going to bed, and then just read one essay. But the essay I read where's the title? Sanitation and the Small Farm. And the funny thing is, this is from 1970s. So this is not even written in the post-2000s industrial era, but it felt so applicable. And he was talking about the role of the home as producer instead of consumer. And I think that even if we were to remove the question of, stability, basically, even if supply chains, all of that, were not a risk with the current setup, just the fact that we no longer generally in our homes produce anything makes us have a more shallow experience often of what it means to live, basically, to be human and to...
Right.
Especially as homemakers, to be making a home.
Right. Well, we lose out on reaping the fruit of our own labor, which is just such a rewarding thing. When everything you buy is from this, everything in your life is purchased,
right,
and you're not producing anything, you don't get to harvest because you haven't planted, sown anything, and so you don't get to really reap anything.
And I was grabbing my phone for a second here as ladies were chatting, because I had to remind myself, oikos is home, and that's where we get economics. Like our word economics is based on the Greek word for the home, the household.
So that home economics is redundant.
The prime, that's the primary producing unit, basically, in any ancient context. And we've really changed that nowadays.
That's a
completely
fascinating,
different.
Right.
Fascinating point.
Right. Know. And of course, there's other ways to steward your home and do all that without farming or doing anything
right.
Like
there
that.
Have always been cities and people there, you would have relationships with the producers in that case often.
Exactly.
So it was still personal.
Right. And I think that
communities are a blessing and really important. And the fact that heaven is described as a city means none of us would be saying, and the city is evil.
Exactly. And so there's rewarding things. If you're raising children in your home and you can't grow a garden, you don't have time for that.
Right.
You're still reaping tons and tons of rewards. Mm-hmm. But I think with that, as women as homemakers, we also have this amazing ability to support with our money, I guess, I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but where our money goes, that's kind of where our heart is as well. Mm-hmm. And if we're supporting other small farms, you're essentially doing the same thing.
You're fostering that kind of growth.
And so there's other ways to take part in the homesteading kind of movement, in the small farm movement, without actually having your hands in it.
And the immediate blessing, I think, that cycles back is when you're, I do think that things are often more nutritional when they're grown that close to home, whether it's honey that helps with allergies, because
local
it's
honey,
local
right?
honey, or, eggs where hens are grazing. Ranging and just eating bugs and eating, right off the ground are generally more nutritional. You can tell just by looking at the yolk.
So
if you're not doing it yourself and you can't have your own backyard flock, it doesn't mean, that's it for you.
When I said, like when I was saying less human, that's not, I realize that could be taken wrong, but just, yeah, the way that we've, in, you know, in the extreme version of living in suburbia, never where going outside.
Where the burden of proof is on someone who's small farming rather than...
Where your food is only something that comes in a package and you don't even want to know, like, ew. You know, that's what raw meat looks like.
Yeah.
Right, doesn't come in a frozen chicken.
Yes, speaking of.
Exactly.
So here's a question for you, because I'm guessing that some people are listening to this are either A, just starting out, or they love the idea, but they're a little bit nervous about starting out. Do you suggest just diving in? Do you suggest, like, what's a good plan?
So obviously it's going to differ for everyone. I think that, yeah, some people, if they're the dive in mentality, that's just going to be what it takes. All or nothing, you know, let's just do this.
And some of us just learn better on the job. And like, we have to make our own mistakes and just do them.
Exactly. Which is kind of where I was. But there are also those that need to plan ahead. And because you also want to avoid the wear out. You know, because there's a lot of lows that come with farming and homesteading, and you could quickly reach that burnout stage if you just dive in without any experience, any knowledge.
A little planning can kind of create longevity.
Yes, exactly. And starting a little bit slower. You know, if you dive in and, you know, you move into your property and 2 weeks later you have
you're milking
a dairy cow and sheep and you have all of these things, you're going to burn out.
I can't imagine who would do something as stupid as getting animals 2 weeks after moving.
I know, right?
That's what, we did that too.
Yes. Jordan already confessed. Valerie, do you have something to say?
I think
we actually got chickens pretty early on too.
Right. But yeah, I think the blessing, especially if you live in a smaller town that allows chickens in your backyard, you know, homesteading doesn't have to be on acreage. You can homestead with a small backyard. You can homestead with a balcony. Joel Salatin is, you know, very known for, like, if you live in an apartment, you can still produce things.
Yes. Well, the whole cubic foot or cubic yard gardening, where you can do so much, and that's, you know, you barely need a patio to be able to do that.
Right. So, well, and everyone can grow a tomato plant in a pot on their windowsill or some herbs.
Yeah. Some of us try. I don't know if we need tomatoes.
Some of us have little helpers who like to dump them out, right?
Oh, yes, of course. And so there's just so many ways that you can homestead wherever you're at, in a sense. You know, if you're in a place where you can't do any animals at your home, or you can't do any gardening because you're renting or whatever it is, you know, learn to can. If you're not cooking from scratch, learn to cook from scratch.
For some of us, just having a sourdough starter that you keep alive is a little bit like farming.
It's something, it really does.
I caught my own straight from the air. So, you know, it's a homegrown sourdough starter, but
I'm realizing as you say that was the very first thing that we ever did that kind of just broke the norm of how we were shopping, getting our food. Like, it was the first thing where I cooked a decent bit from scratch already, but it was the first, like, something that I was cultivating instead of here's some ingredients.
And you're not relying on commercialized yeast in that case. You really can just start from flour and water.
Right.
Which is remarkable to me every time.
Exactly. You know? And those starters are the best because
they're amazingly hardy, I will say, because hardy. I have tortured mine.
I can't tell you how much I tortured mine. And I think I had mine for probably 2 or 3 years, and it was amazing because I could leave it on the counter and not feed it for like 5 days, and it was fine. We did have a very hot summer last year,
and it did take it out,
and I was very sad. And so ever since then, I've been, you know, taking some from other people. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I need to just create my own again, because as gross as it sounds, like, your own bacteria in your own home is going to be the hardiest.
We found that because I've shared mine with people before, and it just has not survived in the same way. But in our own ecosystem, it works just fine.
Right.
Symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
Well, I remember there was a study that they did somewhere in Sweden or something a few years ago with sourdough, and they had something like very precise controls in place with different bakers all over the world doing the exact same process, and just the difference in flavors in every location because of both air, but also the bacteria on your hands, which sounds
you touch it and suddenly it takes on this whole different life.
Right. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. It's really, those kind of things are just amazing to, like, watch how that actual works. It's those systems mm-hmm. that God created that work.
Yeah.
that mm-hmm. work together. So going kind of back to how you can get started. If you live in an area where you can have backyard chickens, mm-hmm. I always tell people they chickens, are the gateway drug.
They are pretty hardy, which is wonderful mm-hmm. because yes. unless you have a dog. Which we won't talk about. Oh, it depends on the dog, of course.
Or a neighborhood raccoon. Also learning from experience there.
We did. Or skunks, which yes. I found out mm-hmm. about because we had probably more than was actually allowed on our very little property in town. And bless our neighbors for tolerating it. But we started to find chickens, I think some of them, it was the chicken breast was eaten. And I think that's a raccoon signature if they uh-huh. remove the head and eat just the chicken breast. But we thought we were catching raccoons and Daniel set a spring trap because we weren't supposed to do away with them in town. And we got skunks. And we got nine skunks over the course of 2 weeks.
Nine.
Daniel got sprayed once really thoroughly trying to neutralize these skunks because there was not really much of an alternative within city limits. But we did eventually take out the skunks, and then a raccoon did turn up at one mm-hmm. on one instance, and he didn't have anything he could grab at the moment, so he grabbed a wooden spoon and he spanked that raccoon right over the fence. But that was our start in defending
your flock. Our flock. Nice. I would like to say we were able to defend ours. We had we had an undisclosed amount of in-town chickens that our neighbor very graciously was yes. like, you know what, if someone calls, you can just tell them that half are mine.
Oh, bless your neighbor. Exactly.
And we unfortunately lost all of them in one night. It was actually a skunk that ripped their throats out.
Not rose-tinted realities.
Yeah, exactly, yes. exactly. Didn't eat any part of them, just ripped their throats out and left them strung out all over our yard and even brought one to one of our neighbors who was not very pleased.
Oh, no, I can imagine.
And so that was our first step.
But aside from those challenges, chickens are generally pretty hardy.
Now that we've yes. scared everyone yeah, off of chickens.
So yes, predators and chickens are not friends, but
full-grown chickens mm-hmm. tolerate single-digit temperatures, mm-hmm. so they can do very hot down to very cold. We have definitely right. documented, we've kept an eye on the coop. Uh-huh. But we've documented it when it was 95 degrees for a week.
Right.
And they did okay. They needed ventilation, mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. other than that, they were fine. So they have that full 100 degree range of tolerance. Yes. Not chicks wouldn't, mm-hmm. but full grown chickens mm-hmm. will. And that makes, that's very simplifies a lot of things right. right there. So with water and then either ability to range or some type of reliable grain or feed, mm-hmm.
They're kitchen really, scraps.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And we definitely, I have to say, I love that. If there's something that feels like it's wasted in our kitchen and I can give it to the chickens and turn it into eggs, mm-hmm. it is just the best feeling.
Oh, it is such a good feeling.
Because it's like, well, that right. veggie that died in the back of my refrigerator because I didn't.
I'm now not having it to pay to dispose of.
I don't have to feel guilty because now I'm going to have very valuable eggs as a result exactly. of the celery that we
exactly.
didn't
exactly. And they're going to turn, not only eggs, but then also fertilizer for your garden to grow yes. more of that. Produce that died in the back mm-hmm. of the fridge,
I have found myself wishing mm-hmm. that we had pigs because you mentioned that yes. they love yes. to slop up like spoiled milk and that mm-hmm. kind of thing or soap.
Everything that a chicken can't have, a pig still can. Yes. Between pigs and chickens, they are really delightful, especially when you have a large family and mm-hmm. there's a lot of food waste. Let's be yes. real.
Life happens. And stuff does get wasted.
Life happens. And yes, and the kids don't always finish all their food. And so it's just, there's a lot of food waste. And it doesn't get wasted because it's going to either the right. chickens or the pigs.
Mm-hmm. Or the garden.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's getting turned into something else, either meat or eggs or fertilizer. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's amazing how that works. And so chickens, mm-hmm. I think, are such a great introduction because they are kind of all encompassing in that way. You can
and they're a protein source, which is kind of a wonderful thing with the volatility of
right.
prices and the market right now.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Well, and eggs are just so nutritious and so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I know that we've gone through in many different eras of health trends. Mm-hmm. Eggs are in or eggs are out, or eggs whites are in or
right,
eggs,
let's not mention cholesterol.
Exactly.
Are you saying I shouldn't mention I eat raw egg yolks?
Mayonnaise, homemade mayonnaise, it's where it's at.
Yes. And so, yeah, you have this valuable source of protein. And you also have this, access to nature. You have this access to this amazing system that God created, and you can see it. You can see the whole cycle of it, and it's amazing. And these birds, they're, you know, some people think chickens are hideous, but, you know, if you actually look at them, like, no, they're actually beautiful. These feathers are so intricate and amazing.
Mostly don't check them out when they're molting. That probably is a bad plan maybe because they look a little odd.
Exactly. Exactly. And then, you know, if you're going to plant a garden, you can take them and you can fence them off in that area, and they will till it up for you.
Yes.
So much faster.
They are amazing how they take down everything that's green on the surface and just kind of work it into the ground.
And then you're not tilling, you're not disturbing kind of the life that's already under there. And so you're not putting anything to waste, really, because then they're going to be fertilizing it as they go. And so, when we were in town, that's what I did. I was, you know, we had our chickens, we raised them.
Kind of moved them in a tractor type scenario.
And I just actually would fence off where I wanted my garden to be. And you know, it was very small, but I'd put them there every before planting, and then I'd top it with my soil. I did lasagna gardening, which was just kind of a great way to kind of use everything we had.
Is that the cardboard layers?
Yeah. So, kind of quick diverge here.
Important tangent.
Important tip. Lasagna gardening is fantastic for, especially in town and small gardens, but even larger scale as well. It's all no-till gardening. And so you don't need to rent a tiller or anything like that. You put cardboard down. And ideally this is done in the fall. You put your cardboard down and then you just start layering it with brown and green composts. And so brown being manures and things like that, like alpaca poop is amazing. Rabbit poop is amazing.
My tulips love alpaca
poop. Yes. Yeah.
Hot tip.
Right, exactly. And those are fantastic if you're doing it on a little bit of a shorter timeline. But you can use, you know,
that'll be less hot over one season.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a cold fertilizer. And so you can use that. You can plant directly into either alpaca or rabbit or pig or sheep manure. You can plant directly into it and it's not going to kill anything.
And we're hoping that lasagna gardening will be the solution for us because we have a lot of fast growing thistles out where we are. Yes. And as soon as you till, the soil is so fertile and lush, they just sprout up. It's kind of insane how quickly they do.
Oh yeah. Well, and you're uncovering all these seeds that were deeper rooted and they're just coming up and they're going to spring to life because hey, I'm in the sunshine now.
Thank you for that. Exactly.
So, and then you can use your grass clippings. You can use your fall leaves, you can use food scraps, you can use all of that, and you're just layering them in the way that they're going to break down faster. Everything's going to compost faster, and they're going to heat your seedlings when you go to the plant, because as the compost is breaking down, it's actually heating and causing this greenhouse effect for your seedlings. And it's really, really cool how it works. And just especially, you know, it's a little bit easier to do on a small scale, just because doing that many layers on a large scale is very difficult. I know. I tried it. Failed. I just couldn't get it
deep. I was going to say, so far we have not succeeded in our plot. We did try with the cardboard and the leaves, although I don't think we did any brown compost, so that might be part of our problem. Okay. We should probably be doing that this next season.
Brown compost is great, and if you can get aged, you know, any kind of aged manure is fine too. I think bovine, if it's been turned.
Chicken is okay, like alpaca?
Chicken is hot. Okay. Chicken actually needs to be aged a year if it's just sitting, or 6 months if you're constantly turning it. Goat poop is cold. You're good there. Yeah, the pellets that spread are great to plant directly in.
Okay.
They're not hot. But anything that comes out in a patty or in a, you know.
Yes, yes.
I'm sure you don't want to plant. Exactly, exactly. And obviously you never want to use dog poop or cat poop or, you know.
Anything that would be nice and bacteria ridden is probably not
exactly. Avoid those. But the rest can all be either aged and composted.
Before someone goes and harvests their backyard. Fido. Manure.
Exactly.
Don't do
it's
not
the same
stuff. Steer clear.
Exactly. Note the wise. So lasagna gardening is great, especially if you can get your chickens. And you know, while I said you don't want to plant directly in chicken fertilizer, if you put them in there before you plant, that amount of fertilizer is not going to harm your plants, especially because they are turning it as they're going. You wouldn't want to have them there for months on end and then it's just this cake of chicken manure. Because you don't want to plant in that. You'd have to wait 6 months if you're turning it or a year if you're just going to let it sit to then plant in it. But if you just let your chickens in there, like, that's not going to hurt anything. That's not enough to scorch the plants.
I follow someone in the UK. I think his name is Robert Downing Jr. I'll have to look him up. But he does no-till farming.
Charles Downing, maybe?
Oh, maybe.
Robert Downing.
I was thinking Robert Downey. This guy is Charles Downing. Thank you. You know one of those names.
Iron Man was a no-till gardener.
Maybe he is, and we don't know. Anyway, we will go ahead and link to the right link for that on Instagram. Thank you, Mel. I love part of my brain at home so much. But he talks about how the yield is better with no-till, and that he's done sort of side-by-side comparisons, and his yields are that something like 40% higher with a no-till gardening practice over time. So I can link to that, and we should probably link to some of our favorite sources overall that people can dive into for resources.
Oh yeah, because there's tons of good.
And your Wendelberry title, we're gonna have to put that one on there too.
I've not read all. I've just read that one essay so far in it, but it was a fantastic essay.
Sounds good.
I had another question. So you've made some mentions of like incorporating kids into it. How do you then? What are some good ways to get kids involved? Because I think for a lot of us, kids either feel like a liability, like how could I go do homesteading when I can barely keep all the kids alive in the house every day? or it feels like just too new and foreign, you know, this is something they're not used to. So what
is it safe for them? What is it?
No, honestly, I think that's one of the biggest perks of homesteading is for your kids. And I know a lot of people will be like, oh, I would, but I've got little kids, or, you know, oh, I need to do that before I have kids so I can gain the knowledge. But you know, it's really a fun thing to grow in as a family because your kids can see you fail and they can see you learn from it.
Yeah.
And that's a very valuable life lesson, especially if you're learning from it joyfully. And
that being the key.
exactly. Joyfulness being the key. And so, yeah, just you can integrate your kids in all of the areas. I mean, I think there's one we don't require that our kids come out for the actual killing when we're slaughtering animals. But there are many things that we do, like we do actually push them to go and do, even if they don't want to do it. And then there's things that we just let them naturally enjoy.
And you mentioned to me there's things, you know, where, you know, that really isn't a safe alternative, like one cow you had that wasn't a great milker for kids. And you're like, you know what, this is probably not sustainable for a family if our kids can't pitch in on this.
Exactly.
Find a better cow.
Exactly. And we're very particular.
Or roosters, like calling a rooster that's really mean. We've all experienced what mean roosters are.
I was scarred by Daniel's rooster when I was five. I got over it.
We did have a couple really mean roosters, and it was nice when they were gone because they did go after the kids. And I feel like that's not a great
recipe for success. Right. Yeah. There are lessons in toughness and braveness to be had. You know, if they're you do have a mean rooster and your kids, you know, it's your kid's job to go and feed the chickens. And there is a point where they do have to like get just past the fear and just
go.
Be brave and go take a stick out with you. But there's also like, I also don't want to scar them and make them not love this because I want them to love this. And so I give roosters two chances. If they puff up at a child more than once, they're in the crock pot.
You're gone.
They're gone.
You'll be delicious.
Exactly. Yes, and that is a long-standing rule. It doesn't matter how beautiful the rooster is. If they puff up more than once, I know they're just going to keep doing it. You know, one time it can be that the kid was being ornery and they needed to learn from what they were doing. But at the same time.
But those
time,
spurs are no joke.
Those
like
spurs
if they
are no
decide
joke.
To go they, in them.
Right. And a lot of people
or the ram
realize,
that
like,
likes
that,
to butt your kids.
Exactly. And like they really can cause some damage. And like we also want to get stewards of our children and make sure that while they're learning lessons, they're not learning them that way. And so, yeah, so picking animals that will allow your children to take part in
like
everything.
Like backyard hens, they really, I mean, they can be gentle to the point where the kids almost consider them pets, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
If you're planning to eat them, you may want to have a little bit of caution
a little more
in that
distance,
regard.
Especially in the first 2 years.
Yes.
Yeah, the first 2 years, anything we were going to eat, we only named food names. So, you know, our first pigs were always, you know, pancetta and prosciutto or, you know, and anything like that. And
it's a foreshadowing.
Exactly. Like that way the kids know like this is the destiny of this animal. Now we're at the point where we just use all book names for everyone and you know, sometimes
and your kids
we
are familiar with how the cycle goes.
They know
the
exactly. Yeah. They're just they're familiar with it and they know from the beginning which ones we plan to eat, which ones we plan to keep.
Right.
And I think that's also very important to kids.
Just
so
be straightforward.
To be straightforward. Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously there's times that you end up having to cull an animal that you had intended to keep, but you know, make sure you're talking to the kids throughout that process. And you know, because we don't want to, they think they have this pet and then all of a sudden you're eating their pet.
Oops.
Bon appetit.
Exactly.
You know. We had a lamb growing up that
we
want
to still be gentle with them in those ways. And so, but yeah, so having all animals that are good with them, there are some pigs that are known for aggression. We don't get those breeds. We get heritage breeds.
Because they can be really destructive.
They can be.
Yeah.
They can be. Pigs can be very dangerous. Especially, you know, when commercially raised, most oftentimes raised in a backyard setting, they're not going to be. The reason they're the way they are in commercial settings is because they're in such close confinement that their brains are just going crazy. Pigs are actually very smart. And so, which is why they're actually trying to breed them right now to where they don't have, I'm trying to remember what emotion it is, but basically trying to breed emotions out of pigs because they are very emotional. And that way they don't stress out so much in the tight environment.
Fascinating and scary.
Which is, yes, exactly.
That's a little disturbing, in fact, if God designed them this way.
Exactly. Again, taking one of those systems that works and turning it into something that intentionally doesn't. And so, but no, so pigs in a good setting, they're not typically going to be aggressive, but of course, because of the way we've bred them, sometimes it's just going to happen. So choosing wise breeds, kind of, you know, when you're picking a dog, you need to choose a wise breed. It's the same thing with livestock. Choose a breed that
if
is
you're
fit
not
for
up
your
for
setting.
Handling a pit bull, don't get a pit bull, you
exactly
know?
Exactly. And so, yeah, so with pigs, you know, we've stuck to mostly heritage breeds. And we've vet the genetics. We make sure that they're gentle, gentle genetics and gentle dispositions. And we go from there because the pigs are my daughter's thing. She loves them.
And
she
things you learn from experience them. Because if you happen to get one that is really aggressive, then you go, okay, well, we had a reroute on this one.
Right, and exactly. And our kids, and our kids know that if it's one we'd planned to keep for breeding, but is aggressive, like they know that, no, that one's going to go because otherwise all the offspring will then be aggressive. And we don't want that because then it would mean we couldn't keep any of them. And so, yeah, same thing with sheep and rams. I mean, the second we have one that starts showing signs of, you know, aggression or that are ornery, we just call them. And the kids know they're like, okay, that's actually going to benefit us in the long haul.
They learn the basis of husbandry and what that looks
like. Exactly. Because then they know that they'll have access to the pasture and they can go cuddle up with the sheep and go do things with them because there's no aggressive ones. With the cows, same thing.
And I think it blesses kids. I noticed this with kids that grow up around dogs. You learn something about their body language. And it actually makes you safer around unfamiliar dogs. And I think it's the same way with other animals as well. You get an intuition for that dog's not doing well. I watched in a coffee shop environment, someone brought their dog in, and a mother who clearly didn't have any experience with dogs was allowing her 2-year-old to approach this very frightened young dog. And I was about ready to just go tap her arm and say, listen, like, I know dog body language. That dog could bite your child because they're really frightened. I mean, it wasn't even a mean dog. It was just a frightened dog. But it's such a benefit to children to have that intuitive grasp of like what their ears are doing, what their voice is doing.
I kind of like to compare it to, I mean, I know this is still debated in many areas, but a netted trampoline versus an unnetted trampoline. We have one without a net, and my kids know how to jump on one without a net because they're not relying on the net to be there at all times.
We have used that approach with small four-wheelers. This might also be controversial, but my son has rolled a small four-wheeler over on himself because he was driving when he was 7 on a little one, and he learned very early on to be cautious. So now when he handles a big four-wheeler, obviously accidents can still happen. But the idea is he's learned.
But they're going to know. It's like letting the toddler climb things and fall because they're going to, that's the one way they're going to learn.
But do it in a smaller environment when they're younger so that then when they're taking their bigger leaps, it's not as dangerous for them.
Exactly. Which is a huge blessing of, you know, having animals that you do trust. Because they can learn to be comfortable around them and learn to read their body language because even the best animal is going to, they're still animals. The best dog could still snap.
My poor boy. My poor boys keep getting stepped on. By our blanket on breed, Caracachan. Caracachan and Pyrenees mix. And
she's a big
huge
dog.
She's really sweet, but huge. And she keeps stepping on their feet when they're out playing. And they'll come to me, Mommy, Bridget stepped on my foot.
And like same thing with the cows. It's like, okay, well, the kids like,
a little more
the cows that are gentle. Like also, they're not the wisest one to go out in the pasture and play with because they're huge. And they're not going to see you and they're going to step on your foot. And if you go rolling or sliding down their pasture, they could step on you or sit on you. And they're not going to know. It's not intentional. It's just part of being a large animal. Don't go playing under their feet. Don't go doing that because like that's just using wisdom. And so I think the homesteading can teach a lot of wisdom and just life skills in general in that area.
Risk-taking in a healthy way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Proverbs makes many references to the animal kingdom as far as what you can learn in terms of wisdom. So we can definitely benefit that way.
And there's so many, you know, so many animal references. You know, go to the ant, you sluggard. And we wouldn't know that if we didn't know how hard ants work.
And it becomes such an intellectual thing if we always read these without ever having any hands-on experience with any of the natural world.
So children basically are blessed that way too, because yeah, they recognize all those things as they grow up and read the Bible and uh-huh, go, oh, I know exactly what that looks like.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And these life skills that a lot of kids don't have. And I love that the connection with food that they have. Another thing Bible talks about is food and feasting. Mm-hmm. Yes. And honestly,
and they value it more because they put the work in.
Yep, I know. Yes. I think our favorite was our first, couple sheep that we butchered. The kids would ask, which name? Sherlock or was this Hulk? they'd go through and it was just this funny thing once they lost the emotional attachment side of things.
But then they could take some pride.
They could take some pride in it and like, oh no, this, we took part in this. Mm-hmm. And they always help with chicken butchering. Mm. We call it chicken harvest. Because there's no personal attachment to these chickens. We raise, Cornish cross. They're not beautiful birds. They are.
They're the ones that have less feathers, right?
They're designed to die.
They are, you call them quickly. Yes.
Mm-hmm. They are designed to not live past 10 to 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. Even raised the way we do. So they're raised commercially. They butcher them between 6 and 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. They're very fast growing. They're grown for the really large breasts. They're grown for the minimal feathers. Mm-hmm. They're grown to not live. You can't actually breed these because they can't make it to that size. Because they will just keep growing and then their organs will start failing and their legs will start breaking.
Okay. Wow. So you wouldn't even be kind to them to let them live.
Exactly. Which is kind of nice when you go to butcher them because you're like, okay, this is actually a mercy killing at this point.
Yes.
So obviously it's still debatable. And we always went back and forth on whether we actually wanted to support raising the breed or not. Mm-hmm. But we're like, you know what? But we can glorify what has been made.
Yeah. And it will be a blessing because it's good meat for families.
Especially when we were selling it, it was, we know that our customers are used to a lot of the white meat, mm-hmm, and the large breast meat, and things like that. And then we're like, okay, but we can take these creatures that are raised so inappropriately, mm-hmm, normally, and raise them appropriately and how God designed them to be raised and steward them well. Mm-hmm. So ours, we usually would take to about 10 to 12 weeks. And, we move them every day, which would force them to exercise. So they were in a box that we would just push them every, twice a day, we'd move them to new grass. Mm-hmm. So they'd get like all the new glorious bugs and they'd have that nice, yellow fat and just all these things that were just so, so wonderful. And we'd take their food away at night so that they didn't grow so fast that they were breaking their legs. And that's a very common thing with that breed.
Oh, wow.
Especially, commercially, you can pretty much rest assured that they all had broken legs by the time
they were there,
which is just sad. And so it's, when we look at stewardship, it's like, okay, is that actually stewarding and taking dominion? Mm-hmm. Or is this, exactly. Yeah. And having the kids take part in that, they just have so much pride in that food. They're so much more willing to finish their food when they know that, like, hey, I know that this chicken gave its life for me, and I'm going to eat this. And so that's another huge, huge asset.
And it also is, the flavors that you turn out are just wonderful in comparison to something that's commercially grown, which is something you also want your children to grow up appreciating.
Right,
to
appreciate
really
good food.
Good flavor. Uh-huh. Yes.
I know. Absolutely. I've gone through it at some points. I'll be like, oh, shoot, my kids are very spoiled because, there's a number of them that refuse to drink any store-bought milk or eat any store-bought eggs. I just absolutely refuse. My oldest especially, because he was in charge of the chickens for many, many years. Uh-huh. And so he loves homegrown eggs.
Mm-hmm.
He still refuses to eat a store-bought egg. And he will look at the color of the yolk and be like, Mom,
nope, that's
this
not
is
it.
A store-bought
yes,
egg.
Yes.
I'm not going to eat it.
So my 8-year-old, when we started getting your raw milk, it just cracked me up that he had figured out which cow he liked the flavor of better. And he would only drink Helen's milk. And I'm like, okay, buddy, I really appreciate this, but also this is going to be problematic because you probably won't always have Helen's milk.
You've heard of wine sommeliers. Have you heard of milk sommeliers?
Yes.
Right, exactly. Oh my goodness. Yeah. So teaching your kids to appreciate good food isn't spoiling. I mean, like, if we're going to spoil our kids, spoil them in a good way.
Yeah.
Spoil them with love and spoil them with good.
It's like giving them a good education. We're spoiling them in a sense by doing that in the best possible way.
And gifts them for later for their knowledge about the world and what they appreciate.
Like, their grocery budget's going to have to be a little higher. Yeah. But what? That's all right.
but their feasting habits will be more elevated and they'll enjoy it more because they appreciate what they're doing.
Right.
Which is
And this is
a wonderful thing.
Right. This food that's actually in the form that God created us to enjoy it in is just amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you compare a homegrown tomato with a store-bought one and she's like, well, this tomato was brought up in a soil that has no nutrition in it and has nothing life-giving in it. And so you're just kind of eating this lifeless tomato versus you grow a tomato at home in your own compost.
And you can tell by the smell. Like, you literally smell the vine, and you already know that smell.
And you know, like, this is what a tomato should taste like.
I recently had the opportunity to taste some homemade maple syrup. And the flavor is just completely different than what you get off the shelf. I mean, I still go for the, you know, maple syrup in the store because we just don't have the alternative here. Sugar maples don't really grow. But someone had passed on some from Canada. And it's just, there's no comparison.
No.
That flavor is just so unique and amazing. And you wouldn't necessarily ever experience it unless you can find someone who's willing to go through the effort to make it themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And then just teaching them that, like, real food actually changes in taste. We'd always have to, like, prep our customers, like, okay, in the spring, by the way, guys, it's going to get outrageously sweet, and if they get into a certain wheat patch, like, then it's going to taste really bitter. And it's just like knowing that, like, okay, real, like, food grows this way.
It's not standardized.
Like, that's, you know, when you go to the store and everything just always tastes the same, it's actually not a great learning lesson because that's not how it works.
I think you just switch your brain off when it comes to sensibilities about flavor, honestly, because you just have expectations.
Exactly.
And then even when it is different, you don't necessarily notice because you're just expecting the same.
Right, right. And I think culture, we've kind of lost a lot of really good taste buds in the sense that we're so used to this, like, deprived food and this just kind of tasteless food. I mean, I know that, like, a lot of people, you were talking about grass-fed meats, that can't stand them, and I get that. We were that way for years. It's it's hard to acquire the taste for grass-fed meat because it, you know, the word we use is gamey.
Right.
It's like, actually, that's just what meat tastes like.
Right.
But if you stuff it full of corn, you can then get this other taste that actually tastes
less meaty.
Right. It's less meaty. Less flavor, it's not that grass-fed meat is more gamey. It's that corn-fed is
I have to say, a revelation for me was when we had neighbors that ran a Chinese restaurant, and they would butcher out their own meat. And so they had all the remaining cuts that they would turn into ground beef, and they would gift it to us. And when I first experienced freshly ground beef, and it has almost no smell, which was just, when you get it from the store, it's got that real
kind of funky,
juicy, funky smell. Like, it's not a nice smell. And they would bring it to us, and you'd pick up the bowl and, like, stick your nose in it and go, it smells fresh. Like, I'm sure that's, you know, if you eat tartar, which I didn't grow up eating tartar, but that's probably the experience you have, you know. But that, like, wow, this is fresh meat. This is something completely different.
It is. And it's, sometimes it's an immediate loving for it. And, like, I know that when we were selling milk, it was so fun to see different people's reactions to the milk. Kind of like you guys were all, like, just, like,
excited.
Right away, just like, oh, this is so awesome.
People going,
like, oh, this is not a taste I'm used to.
It did take me a little while to get used to it. I loved it.
Yeah, and it's so different from everyone. I mean, everyone's taste buds are so different.
Well, experiences with goat milk, similarly, like trying to find a good way to do the goat milk flavor. Because it's its own thing.
She was amazing at first, and then I gave you some of her milk, and by that point it started tasting goaty again.
Although I didn't dislike it even still, but it might be that I just need to hone my taste buds more.
Or on the contrary, you have the palate that can handle it, and I have my suburban little palate.
It's so funny. Like, everyone is so different. My husband, you know, can sometimes not taste the difference between store-bought this or, you know, homegrown that, but could also taste the difference between our different breeds of sheep. He actually gained, like, preferences of, like, I prefer the Shetland the thin. And so it was just like this, like, we're also built so differently and what our taste buds are. But
community, we can bless each other.
Exactly.
Because we have different giftings in those areas.
Exactly. Yeah. And speaking of community, that's like another huge blessing, I think, just both to us as adults and to the kids, is a community that comes with homesteading. And it's funny, we talked to, like, one of the complaints that people have about homesteading is the lack of community. It's like, well, obviously you have know nothing about the culture because
there's a huge community.
I mean,
it's growing rapidly.
Hugely. And we've met more and more interesting people just through buying hay or through buying livestock or just so many different experiences that you can know people on such a different level. You know, you think of city life.
Because it's something
life.
They're putting their hand and time to in a really devoted way.
Exactly. And so therefore they're going to put the same amount of effort into who they're selling it to. We've met so many fantastic people that we never would have come across otherwise. You know, and you think of, you know.
So it's not escapism.
It's not escapism. Right.
And these are long-term relationships often, too. It's not just, you know, the checker at the grocery store or the DoorDash delivery that you see once and then never see again.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I was going to say is, you know, some people say that, you know, that city life is actually the greater community because there's so many people. It's like, yes, but it's also designing itself to not need people.
It does compartmentalize
you. When your groceries come to your door and, you know, anything you order can be delivered by drone. You know, you know, like, talk about taking community away. That's taking community away. Yeah. Versus in homesteading, if you're doing it in a way that it's going to thrive, you're going to have a strong community.
And you're
going to
know that you need that community. And you're going to know,
yeah, exactly. You need other people's experiences. Yes. You need other people's knowledge and education because you could have been doing this for 50 years, but someone else could have been doing a different part of it for 50 years and they're going to know a lot more.
And we are limited by our finiteness to not be able to learn everything in a lifetime about how to do these things.
Exactly. Yeah. So having the help of neighbors and just other people that you meet is so hugely beneficial and just learning to accept all these different approaches and all these different ways and trying them out for yourself. And if it doesn't work, there's no offense taken. It's just didn't work for my farm. And so it's just kind of this amazing community. But in the knowing that you can't do it all, you can't be self-sustaining because guess what? We can't actually grow everything on our 7 acres. Right. Like, we couldn't possibly grow enough hay and
the vegetables
and the livestock and all of that on that acreage. And so you have to meet people and you have this really tight-knit community. And that's really neat.
Learning and growing through relationships.
And then there's the physical help that you need, you know, in unloading and loading hay. I think my favorite story of, you know, our however many years we've been doing this, was we were buying hay from this couple. They're from Germany and just neat couple. We had picked up our first batch of hay the week before, and then we were coming up on the next weekend, and it looked like rain. And so the guy texted me. He's like, hey, you're going to want to come get this hay out of the field because we were paying a really low price for it. So we just had to pick it up ourselves out of the field. It was baled and everything. But
he was warning you it was going to be wet.
He was warning me it could possibly get wet. And we'd already paid for it at that point. So he's like, you want to come get this out of the field? But my husband was working and he had meetings all day and couldn't do it. And so I had to pack up the kids and load up the trailer and we hit the road to go get this hay out of the field. In which case was also a great opportunity for the kids because my oldest, who is at the time 9, had to drive our Suburban with the trailer through the field so that I could stack the hay.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And then about, you know, a couple hours into it, the guy, the farmer, was also gone, but his wife came down. I had my baby strapped to my chest. She had her baby strapped to her chest. Wow. And we continued and loading the rest of the hay.
Yes.
And we got that hay in. And we just developed this relationship that was just so comical but so fun because here, you know, here are these very different
making
people
it happen because you need to because the rain's coming.
Right. And both of us were used to our husbands always being there for this kind of stuff. And so this was like totally new work for us.
I do think that homesteading life also generates opportunities to have some grit and some determination, which is a true blessing as well.
It is.
You know, just as far as, especially for little boys, I think, we all have a bunch of little boys, it really gives them some pluck and determination as they learn that, you know, I'm up against it and I've still got to make this happen.
The rain's coming.
How do I do it?
Hay has to be picked up.
Yeah, and I think anytime we've been tempted to kind of give up just on the whole venture, because, you know, it does get hard. It gets very hard. And it can be very depressing.
And the consistency required is tiring.
But then we look at our 5 boys and our daughter and we're like, no, but this has been so good for them to learn this way of life.
Building.
It's very character building. They have to learn so much. And it's like sometimes, you know, people can be like, oh, you're just making them grow up too quickly. Like, well, no, because they still have plenty of time to play. I mean, homeschool. And so
and plenty of scope for the imagination when they do play. I think there's that,
oh, my
too.
Goodness. I can't tell you how many forts have been made in the haystacks and, you know, the games that they've discovered and things like that. It's just so much more imaginative. You know, the fact that a lot of their math skills have come from building chicken coops or, you know, taking all the scrap pieces
or
from
not
the
counting
project.
Your chickens before they're hatched, right?
Exactly. And so just all these, you know, there's life skills and there's just these different things that they can learn. But the grit is really, especially for the boys. I mean, for the girls too. I mean, it's highly valuable in this.
I mean, mamas need to have some grit, you know?
Right, we really do.
Child rearing is difficult.
Exactly. We need to know that we can, like, there can still be things that we can handle during difficult times, and that's okay. Obviously, I love being able to rely on my husband for the heavy parts. But it's also good for us women to know how to work hard.
Right.
And it's, you know, there's still
and it's something of a lost art, I think.
It is. So. It really is.
And I think there's something, too, to be said. So there are other ways to, you know, pursue grit in life as you're raising kids. But there is something that is so, just from a kind of philosophical aesthetic perspective, something so beautiful about it being in the natural context of a productive home. And so instead
because there are those rewards built into that whole scenario.
It's very, for lack of a better word, holistic. In other words, it's not, you don't have to go. And I feel this way even about like exercise. You know, I enjoy working out in a more formal setting, but I love the idea that at least I can get some of my exercise. I feel like it ought to be all of it, but I haven't gotten there yet. But I can at least get some of my exercise through, you know, carrying water buckets to the goats or lifting hay bales or different things like that, instead of it just being something that happens in a very kind of sterilized, isolated setting of a gym.
And it's, and it's just all around easier. Yeah. Like you said, like, it's not that you can't teach grit in other ways, you know, outside of this lifestyle.
But it just presents itself. Plenty of
it's a natural, you don't have to seek it. It just happens. Like, I remember the first time my oldest, when he was so scared of dirt that, you know, on his first birthday, when I gave him a chocolate cake, he touched it and goes, "Ooh, aki snacking, mama, snacking." And went from that child to, I remember when he picked up his first worm, I was just like, he touched the dirt. I'm so excited.
I have one child a little bit like that. And that's part of why we're doing what we're doing.
Exactly. And then, you know, to know, seeing him now, who, you know, has no qualms with jumping in the mud to go help a calf that's stuck, or you know,
and what a gift to him and as a future man as he grows.
Go and, you know, pull a stuck lamb. Men will be called
to do those things.
And there's so many of those things. I'm just like, you know, you need to know how to do this. You know, not that, you know, not because of, you know, where the world is coming to. You know, we're gonna go back to all this one day. It's like, you know, not the fear mentality, but just of like learning how to work with your hands is a very important skill, no matter where he goes.
Right, and if we study history, we know that hard times come. And it's not like a, oh, and I'm afraid of it, you know, because, you know, it even the laughing at the future type references from Proverbs, you know, you know, she prepares her household so that she doesn't have to fear the future is kind of a, that's of a virtue.
Our version of clothes and scarlet could be, you know, my kids know how to work.
Yes.
If ever the time comes, like, that they can do that. Yeah, exactly. And it just opens up a such a whole new world of what their careers could be, you know, whether they choose to, you know, do the office life they choose, because there's huge benefits to that as well.
But they know how to handle something that comes to them as an unexpected challenge or grind. They've seen it before. And they know how to do it.
And there's always going to be labor work.
Always. We'll always be that. That's part of our life.
Exactly. And even just, you know, maintaining their own house and, you know, things like that. And so there's just so many rewards for kids in this kind of lifestyle that I just think it's such a blessing.
It's not just a personal blessing to us, but to our whole family.
And of course it's going to take sacrifice, you know, because it is harder to do with kids. You know, whether it be, you know, it's kind of like the mom who's trying to teach the child
organized.
How to cook. Like, it's less organized, right? Like, it's not going to be this beautiful, picture perfect, like, oh, we're just going to bake this over here and things are going to go so well, when really flour's being thrown and fights are being had and tears are going
on.
All the dishes broken. And, you know, it's very similar, and we don't have this beautiful farm. I mean, oh my goodness, I always have to prepare people, like this just is so real you guys life. Know, this is real. There's a lot of mud. There's a lot of holes dug in the front yard.
I know when our spring eggs come out, and it's like, I didn't wash them because I wanted you to get them unwashed, but there is mud on it because the chickens just walk through mud. So just know that they will need to be rinsed.
Exactly.
But I always want, I feel a little bit like I have to apologize for it because it comes as a bit of a shock sometimes. This has been amazing, Jordan. Thank you so much for coming and talking with us. I feel like we could probably visit for hours about so many details. But we'll try to include helpful resources in the show notes. And, you know, if you have more questions and want to know more, you can certainly email the podcast and we can forward questions along to Jordan as well to get her wise advice.
In case you didn't have enough on your plate, now we're going to make you the next mentor for everyone.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're very grateful for
I'm not, definitely not wise in everything, but I do love being able to share our failures.
Well, we're so grateful for the time, and we'll look forward to discussing homesteading more over the years.
Thanks again, Jordan. Sounds great. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.